Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
Thanks for being here today. I want to share a few things we've experienced over the last almost 10 years now as church planners, and this whole idea of power in diversity. I read one of the most powerful quotes in a book. I can't remember which book it was. But would your community notice if your church doors shut down tomorrow? What will they say? And so our story actually starts that way because while we had church planted, the church that we are currently pastoring was a church that had shut its doors down. This is a church building that was church ministry that was founded in September of 1910. So we're talking about a 100-year story. And towards the early 2000s, the church actually shut its doors down because of what we are going to be talking about today. There was no intentionality with being a diverse church that would meet the needs of its immediate community. And so what happened was, obviously a church in 1910 is going to look very different to a church in 2010. Yes. And so what happened was, it was pretty much the same, a lot of the same leadership. Of course, they were all in their 70s and 80s. And the community had drastically changed. You know, there were, Long Beach is known for having a lot of Cambodians, African Americans, and Hispanics, Latinos. And so with time, the church no longer was a church that was relevant to meet the needs of its immediate community. And so when we church planted, here's what the interesting was, is that we were the same type of church that this church was that closed down. And by that, I mean, we were, while this church was predominantly one race, our church plant was predominantly one race. And so we merged our churches thinking that both groups would immediately create a diverse group of people within the church. But just because you're all under the same roof, if you have not been intentional about understanding the clear vision for the needs of that community, just because you look different doesn't mean that you're working towards the same goal. And so what we obviously made our efforts to be was, we will not let this church shut down again. That's the goal now. So here we are almost 10 years later. The church is still going. It's growing. It's healthy. It's thriving. But we want to share with you guys some practical things that we've had to do to learn how to get out of our comfort zones and embrace the uniqueness, the beauty of the diversity in the cities that God is calling us to pastor in. So you want to share a little bit about?
Yeah. So, you know, both Josh and I grew up in a Spanish church. I, even more than Josh, grew up in a Spanish-speaking home. So I grew up with parents from immigrants from Mexico who don't speak English. They've been here for 40 years or so or longer, and they still don't speak English. So they are that couple that has not had the need to learn to speak English. They're in a very Hispanic community. The grocery stores, life all around them, Spanish-speaking. So they have never felt the need to really engage any community outside of their own. And so that's how I was brought up. The family community, the church community, my school community was all very much Latino. It was a very, very ethnocentric upbringing. I had no diversity in my life. And so when God calls us out of the very comfortable place, which is East LA, which has our idea was, we're going to church plant and we're going to reach second and third generation Latinos who are not going to church anymore, because they don't understand the language, or because we thought we'll do an English version of the Spanish church, and that's how we're going to reach the people. And God's plans were very different from ours.
Very.
As they tend to be at times. But what's great is that we had no problem with dreaming and believing God and being risk takers and taking steps towards what's unfamiliar and unknown, because we really felt God was the one leading us. So when we moved from being in East LA to pastoring in Long Beach and uniting this church plant, it was a complete disconnect for me. I had never been around people from so many races, outside of maybe going to the mall or at the movie theater. But when you're pastoring and you're leading, all of a sudden there's a community in front of you that looks nothing like you, whose stories look nothing like yours. I was just like, wow, like, this is crazy. Like, I never imagined, I could have never dreamt that, first of all, I never even thought that this was something valuable or important. I realize now that in God's plan, all of these things have established us as a church in our city. But I'll tell you, it wasn't easy for me, because by nature, I naturally gravitated to people who were like me, and people who talked like I did or who enjoyed the same things I did, and who I felt really very much at home with. And so God was having to deal with my heart to really establish the value of what he was going to trust us in from this point forward. It's not even for this season, because I can't ever see myself going back to the world that I came from, which was a very ethnocentric world. There's a lot of great stories that have come out of that, but there's a lot of things that I wish would have been different, because my life has been enriched by viewing relationship with God through the lens of many cultures, experiences, stories, ethnicities, and so this has definitely what has provided us with the platform for what God is doing in our church and in our city. So in today's talk, we want to share with you what that may look like. Now, granted, some of us do come from very ethnocentric backgrounds and church where it's been safe and comfortable. Taking the step towards the multi-ethnic setting is going to present you with challenges. It's going to present you with even viewing yourself in ways that you never even thought you thought, because God is going to deal with your heart. He's going to deal with maybe sometimes even underlying hidden prejudices that you were completely oblivious to, because you didn't have to engage with anybody who was any different from you. And so God had to do that with me as a Latina, engaging now a community that had white, black, Cambodian, Samoan, Filipino, I mean, Brazilian, Middle Eastern. It was a beautiful picture of heaven, and God wanted me to not only embrace it, but to lead in that setting. And so for us, it's definitely been something that's not only grown us, but it's grown the church and the influence that God has provided us for in the city. So when we think about the multi-ethnic church, I mean, we've got some great books back there, none of which we have written, but our friend,
good friend Mark DeMoss.
Mark DeMoss.
If you want to know more about a healthy multi-ethnic model for your church, those are the books that you want.
Yeah, because, you know, here's the thing is that the world is becoming increasingly urban. Our cities are being, there's diversity in our cities, and the more segregated and systemically segregated the church becomes on a Sunday morning, the more odd we will seem to the world. Yeah. They will look at us and say, you talk of a loving God, of a loving Father, a God who loves all people, but I guess he loves them in clusters, or what's the deal here? And here's what's interesting is that before we started pastoring the church that we're at now, where it's a beautiful melting pot of just different ethnicities, I personally, you know, in the Latino church, you feel like you're multi-ethnic because the Latino church will have people from different cultures in it. I mean, I thought I was very multi-ethnic because I'm Mexican and I married a Salvadorian. And I thought, like, I am very multi-ethnic. You know, but in reality, there's so many similarities and so many things that make us comfortable with each other. And for obviously the Latino church, when you're there, you feel like you're multi-ethnic because you're engaging with people who are not from the same towns or Mexico or Colombia or countries you're from. And so you feel like, oh, I'm engaging the kingdom. But then there's a very segregated Latino world that is not embracing or working with the larger part of the kingdom. And so God needed to deal with us in that setting because he was going to trust us with more. And the way he was going to trust us with more influence was with our willingness to be stretched out of our very comfortable setting. And he's definitely stretched us out of our original shape. Once you get stretched out of your original shape, it's really difficult to go back to it.
Yeah.
And so for us, this has been the case. And it's definitely given us some great opportunities in our city because of what the body and the church that we're pastoring reflects.
Yeah, first and foremost, we if you have to get to know the community that you're pastoring. So you shouldn't deal with guilt if your community isn't diverse. So don't put that over yourself. I think that's what happened to so many people. You'll go to a conference and all they're talking about is multi-ethnic, but your community doesn't look multi-ethnic. So don't walk away feeling guilty. If it's not guilt, if it's not multi-ethnic, I believe that God's not asking you to force that down your community, because that's not who your community's become. However, if your community looks different to what your church looks like, then there's definitely work that needs to be done. And so there's two types of churches in America. There's a commuting church, and then there's a neighborhood church. And so commuting churches, you'd be surprised, most churches are commuting churches. This is what that means. This church was found and built in 1942. It's been dad's church, grandpa's church, great-grandpa's church, so our families and our friends have always gone here. None of us live in this neighborhood. We all live at least 45 minutes away, but on Sundays, we all drive into this little neighborhood. Listen carefully. We are completely disconnected from the neighborhood. We don't know the neighbors. We don't know who owns the liquor store on the corner. We don't know who owns the house next to the church. We know that they don't like us because we take all the parking and we make a lot of noise on Sunday. But we don't know who they are. We don't apologize. We're not good neighbors. But that is a commuting church. So we are obviously, those types of churches have become churches that are completely disconnected from their community. So if something tragic happens and the church doors closes down, guess what? The neighbors are going to be happy. Yeah. The neighbors are going to be like, glad. Are they giving up the property for sale? Because we want to turn that into some apartment buildings or something. Mm-hmm. You know. And then you have neighborhood churches. And neighborhood churches can do one or the other. They can immediately become a church that's bringing life to its community, a church that's bringing the message of the gospel, Jesus Christ, a tangible expression of what Jesus Christ wants them to do in their community. Or you could have a neighborhood church that's completely isolated. Although they're in their communities, they're completely isolated to the needs of the community. And so we want to talk a little bit about diversity. And so one of the first things you can do is get to know your community. Get to know your neighbors. Get to know the owner of the liquor store on the corner. You should know them by name. Mm-hmm. As a business owner, you should know who they are, what time they're working. Go, as a matter of fact, I'd encourage you, start buying the stuff that you need from your church. Build that relationship. Mm-hmm. You know that we have a liquor store right at the corner of our church. I walk over there, and because of the type of ministry that we do, on my way over there, I've already said hello to like four or five homeless people that are on that corner, because guess where they hang out? By the liquor store. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The liquor store owner knows me. We're buying stuff. He's talking to me about the students who came Tuesday nights from our high school group to the liquor store. There's an open relationship and dialogue. We walk to Starbucks, which is on the next corner. We know the employees at Starbucks. Right across the street from our church is the Substance Abuse Foundation of Long Beach, and we'll talk about this diversity. As we walk across the street from the church, every inmate who is sent from prison into this transitional housing for a whole year in the Substance Abuse Foundation, we know who they are. Some of them, we haven't gotten to meet them, but they've attended our church services because we've become a neighborhood church. And as we get to know our church, we know our neighbors, we know that in our neighborhood, we have some Hispanic Latinos, we have African Americans, we have a hipster community, we have young adults, we have retired people. If you drive five blocks south from our church, guess what? You have $3 million homes. If you drive five blocks down north from our church, you're in the Section 8 part of the city. If you don't know what Section 8, you definitely don't know urban ministry. We know this. How do we know this? We went outside and we walked the streets. We walked the neighborhood. And as we walked the neighborhood, seeing the beautiful display of the diversity, because I'll tell you this much, unless you have the heart of God, you would think that only the $3 million side of the city is beautiful, but it's all beautiful.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
It's all beautiful. Yes. And so becoming a church that's relevant to its community, that's immediately connected to its neighborhood, is you have to get to know the people that are around there. And it's impossible to know how to minister to them if you don't know who they are.
Yeah.
How many parents are in the room? My parents, all right. So you know, how many of you already know the type of whining your kids make when they're hungry? It's a very different type of whining than when they're tired. Right? You can identify that because you know them. You know the child, they're hungry. I know that distinct, annoying whine, right? I know it. I know that cry. It's so annoying. They're hungry. You give them something, guess what? It's over. But the whine that they, the type of whining that they do when they're tired and sleepy is very different. It might not be as annoying. It's just like they're just fussy. They're angry. You know, the only reason why you know that is because you're doing life with them. Mm-hmm. And I remember shortly after we got to the city of Long Beach, met with one of the first meetings that I had with people of influence in our city was with the chief of police. And I went to meet with the chief of police. And I mean, you can only imagine how many pastors he met with. And I could tell he was annoyed to meet with me because he saw me. I was a young guy. I wasn't dressed like a pastor. I wasn't wearing a suit and tie. I was wearing a t-shirt and some cut-up, some jean shorts or something. And I walk in and he's looking at me like, oh, like, you're the pastor? I'm like, yeah, I'm the pastor. Yeah, I'm a new pastor in town and I'm here. And I asked him a question, and we only spent about 10 minutes talking. And I said, hey, how can we serve the city? And he said something to me that made perfect sense. Coming back to this analogy of knowing the cry of your children, he said, the city needs a father. He said, the city needs a father. And when he said that, I thought, how can I learn to parent the city? Because as a church, guess what we're doing? We're parenting them. We're loving them. We're discipling them. We're caring for them. We're seeking the peace and the prosperity of the city. And I'll let my wife talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, we had to learn how to do that. So here's what happens many times. We'll go out of our way and we'll meet the people of influence. We'll meet the chief of police. We'll meet the mayor. We'll meet the councilman to the district of the part of the city that you're a part of. You'll meet the people of influence. But just meeting them isn't enough. You got to go the next step. Now that I've met them and they've shared with me some of their perspective of the city, now I have to start engaging in things that will give me the opportunity to now serve and love my community. And that's when you begin that motion of providing diversity to be a part of what your church ministry is going to come like. So when we started there at 7th Street Church, we were predominantly an 80% Latino church. And the next 20% was, you know, probably 10% white, and then the rest was mixed, all of the above. You know, it was just a very short. So the multi-ethnic setting wasn't healthy. It was almost forced because we merged churches. We made it happen. You had a dying church, you had a growing church, and we were desperate for a building, they were desperate for people. So it worked out. But had we not been intentional of reaching out to the local universities, local student high schools, local, the brokenness of our, had we not been intentional about that and pushing past our own comfort zone, because like Noemi said, we will sometimes, in doing so, we will get exposed to unspoken prejudices that we have that we don't realize we have.
Yeah.
When we see how other people raise their children and they're not to our standards, trust me, we become prejudiced. I would never do that to my kids. When we see other people's, you know, hygiene standards and how they live, guess what? We become very prejudiced. And we categorize people because of the way one person is. We categorize their whole culture as being that way. Mm. You know, but it's impossible to pastor a city that looks so beautiful in diversity if we never get to know them. And if we're not intentional about pushing past our own comforts so that at the end of the day, we get to introduce to them the only reason why we are in their city to begin with.
That's right. Yep.
To preach the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So, you know, the importance of, for us, obviously, in the space of having diversity in our church and the multi-ethnic conversations that we're having with you guys, you know, it's really important for us to understand that this multi-ethnic experience has provided us with credibility in our city.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, a few months ago, I spoke at there's various organizations in the city of Long Beach that help like single moms or women who are battered and abused. So I went to one of these homes to share with the women there. And the lady who runs that organization spoke to me and she said, I need to find a way to connect these women to your church because we've connected them to a different church. And she said that church is primarily one race. It's from a specific standard of living. And the ladies, when they arrive there, feel like they are a project. And so she said, we need diversity. We need a place that's safe where they're not going to feel like our project has arrived. Like let's fix them, you know? So, you know, literally the multi-ethnic setting of our church, the life of the church has provided credibility with even these organizations where they say, you know what, we trust you. We trust you because we know that you're not going to look at a situation through your own life's lens experience or through what's familiar or what you know, but you know that you're dealing with people who come from very diverse backgrounds. Both, you know, our church is not only multi-ethnic, but it is also very socioeconomically diverse.
And multi-generational.
And multi-generational. So you're going to have all of these different voices and different lifestyles coming through those doors. So we're not going to have a prescription on how to deal with one person's issues like it is for everybody else. So these organizations say, we trust you. We trust you that if we send somebody to your church, they're not going to feel like somebody's project. They're not going to feel like outcasts. They're not going to feel like there's nothing there that looks like them or looks like them. And so when the church is a church that is not multi-ethnic, that is what would be homogeneous church that is about just one ethnicity in a very multi-ethnic setting, it causes the people around to question like, huh, why is that church only for those people? Why aren't other people coming in the doors of that church? And so, like Josh said, we've had these conversations with people in our city. We've had these conversations with people in authority. And the fact that our church looks the way it looks has definitely opened doors of opportunity for us to serve people that might otherwise have never come to our church because the city themselves have sent them to us. Like the Substance Abuse Foundation. The Substance Abuse Foundation of Long Beach is across the street from our church. They work with us. They literally give the people who live in these housings permission to leave the facility where they are for a few hours to come to our church because they know it's a safe place for them. It'll provide life for them. It'll give them an opportunity to hear a message. And so they don't feel like we can't send them there because it makes absolutely no sense in their world. We have to be relevant to the culture that is around us.
And even in that, so I want to pause there for a second because sometimes it's easy to say what we're doing without talking about the discomfort we've had to live to actually accommodate that. You know, so we're talking about people that are coming out of prison, and as they exit prison, they're in a halfway house or recovery program, a government-funded program to transition them back into society. And so what that looks like for us is we have to be ready for whatever that looks like. We're talking about a two-hour pass on Sunday. And the only pass that they get on Sunday is to go to church. Mm-hmm. They're excited they get to leave their recovery house, but they're not excited that they have to go to church. So the discomfort is the reality is this, and you know, we're friends here, so don't tell anybody who didn't make it.
You're being recorded.
So the reality is from that side of the street to this side of the street, here's the reality of a broken city. Mm-hmm. Transactions are being happening just as they cross the street. They know what's happening.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised as they have to come to church because they send a worker to make sure that they're there and they actually get credit for attending church.
Wow.
So we as a church have to push past the fact that some of them walk in smelling like a cloud of marijuana. Some of them walk in smelling like alcohol or like cigarettes. Wait a minute, we're a church though.
Some of them like, have serious records.
And, you know, some of them have serious records. And so we want to talk about, you know, there's different types of diversity, not just the multi-ethnic barrier, but what we want to make this about is this might not be the case in your city. And if it's not the case in your city, don't feel bad. Yeah. God's not calling you to do this. But at some level, there's someone that's living doors away from your church home that still does not know Jesus, And the barrier to that is not them. The barrier to that is the way we are doing church. Because if they don't look like us, and they don't dress like us, and they don't worship like us, then they don't belong with us. And so on Sunday, we put on this beautiful show because it made us feel good to worship Jesus, and we missed the opportunity of embracing different, you know, ethnicities and different expressions of life and people that are doing them. So it's about embracing that that tension.
Yep.
And I would go as far as saying this: God is alive in that tension. God is so alive in that tension. Because as you know, I grew up in the church my whole life, and so the old church folks would say this is holy anger. If you don't respect the house of the Lord, right? You know, it's like there's got to be order in the house of the Lord. And you know, part of me was I had to wrestle through my own religiosity and my own religious mindset, thinking they're not worthy to be in here, but in reality, neither am I. Because it is His grace that makes me worthy.
Amen. Yeah.
And so the good side to this is as we have found creative ways to serve them. Because obviously, if you haven't already thought this, well, what else are you doing for them? You can't just expect them to come to church on Sunday on a 2-hour recess and expect change to happen in their lives. No, you know, we've partnered with Saddleback Church. We launched Celebrate Recovery. And so now they get a 2-hour recess on Sunday for church, and then they get another 2-hour recess on Thursday. Well, guess what we do for them on Thursday? We give them a good dinner. They love our dinner because it's better than the one they got in their Substance Abuse Foundation. They get a dinner from 6 to 7. At 7 o'clock, we give them a worship service. And then at 8 o'clock, we introduce them to support groups in a Christ-centered 12-step recovery program. So guess what? It didn't just happen from night to day. We had to know that there was something different in our community that required us as a church to adapt to it. Guess what this did for us? Not only did it provide for us to see people getting saved, we have cases that we've lost. We've seen people get it and then after 6 months, 12 months, relapse and go back to their old lifestyles. But we've seen the other extreme cases where we've seen people just turn their lives around and give their lives to Jesus.
Get their kids back.
I was going to go there. So here's the thing. Most of the mothers that are in the program, guess what? Their kids, guess where they're at? In foster care. So what was the next thing we decided to do? Well, guess what? Let's find a way. We have their moms coming to church. We have them coming to our recovery program. We need to find a way to get their kids here so that we can unite the families back together. So my wife collaborated with a group of ladies to get a conversation going with the Department of Children and Family Service. And go ahead, tell them how that turned out.
Well, for a time we had what was like a visitation center in our church. And so we had people in our church who they did a whole background check on them, and they were able to be the ones who monitor the visits between the moms who would come across the street. We provided a room that looked like a living room and a kitchen, and if the mom wanted to cook for the child, the food that the child likes, they can cook for them. And it wasn't like a cold, stale office where they have to re-engage their kids. And we've seen some of these moms get their kids back after their kids have been taken away for quite some time. So that was an exciting season for us. Thankfully, the Department of Child and Family Services has said this really is a good idea, and they've opened up spaces where they've created the whole family living room feeling so that they're not having to go into offices or meet in random places.
They used our church model to implement that. The county's now doing that.
Yeah.
So in the county offices, they've created a living room type of environment with a kitchen so that when moms and their children meet, they have a living room setting as opposed to meeting in an office with a social worker, you know. In very few cases would you have a child kind of go to a corner where they didn't want to be with mom and dad. Almost every time, the moment that child saw their mom, regardless of what happened, regardless of why they got taken away, you just saw that child run to their parent and want to be with them. And I believe that is embracing a level of diversity in your community. Again, that might not be the thing. So how we became multi-ethnic. So, you know, like I said, our church, Long Beach is known as an international city. It's a melting pot, different not just ethnicities, but cultures as well. And so how have we been able to, what things have we done as a church to speak that into our community so that they know as they walk in, does someone look like me? Here's some practical things. We are intentional of keeping our stage diversified. We are intentional of our stage being diversified. So on any given Sunday, you will see someone of your ethnic background or someone that looks like you on stage. They might not be from the same country, but they'll look like you. We are intentional about that. As a matter of fact, when I go on Planning Center, if you guys use Planning Center, when I go on Planning Center and I see the singers that are scheduled for the weekend, I'm like, okay, brown, okay, we need to change this up right now. So I'll contact our worship director, we need to diversify our stage. Our stage has to be. So those are one of the things that you guys can put to practice. Again, if you are in a multi-ethnic setting, these are things that are valuable and important too. That, so we went, aside from diversifying our volunteers in our stage, we've diversified our staff. So I've intentionally told my whole team, because Noemi's brown, and I'm brown, well, she's light-skinned brown, but I'm dark-skinned brown. I've intentionally told my team, my executive pastor and our teams, like, I'm not hiring any more brown people. We have enough of us. I don't care how good they are. Because it doesn't reflect our city. It doesn't reflect our community. It doesn't reflect the students that are going to Wilson High down the street. And so one of the things that I believe God is speaking to this idea of multi-ethnic church planting, just the diversity and the power that is in that diversity, is that as you begin to become that type of church, God begins to grant you as a church influence in your city. He begins to give you keys to areas in the city that you didn't have access to before. I can't remember which speaker at the general session has said it, but he says, we don't pastor our church, we pastor our city. Mm-hmm. And as a product to pastor our city, our church is full. Mm-hmm. That's the goal here.
Yes.
That's the goal here. As we pastor our city, our churches are getting full. And so some of the things that we are doing to serve
I do want to share this scripture. Josh shared this a few weeks ago at our church. You know, that verse in Jeremiah 29:11 that everybody reads, and I'm just done with it. Everybody quotes it, for I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord, right? Well, if you read the verses...
It's so beautiful.
He has plans for me. Okay, but if you read the verses before that, it says it's asking the people of God to seek the peace of the city.
Yeah. Yes.
And then after you have done so, then he says, for I know the plans I have for you.
Yeah.
So there's a promise, there's a premise, and God's promise will be fulfilled when we do our part of it.
Yes.
And so if we're going to be a people who are engaging and enjoying the beauty of the plans that God has for us, then we need to be willing to seek the peace of the city, because as the city prospers, we too will prosper, right? So there are certain things that we realize take people's peace away. Some of the things that we realize takes people's peace, all people of all colors, is hunger. You know, if you're hungry, you don't have peace. I don't know about you, because when I'm hungry, I don't have peace.
So, I know that voice.
He knows that voice. So, you know, we have a team that we have a food bank. The list is easy things that you could serve your city. And when you have a food bank, you will see not just one ethnicity. You will see all ethnicities coming. There's difficult seasons for every family, difficult time, difficult years, for crying out loud, for certain families. So we have a food bank that's feeding our community.
So part of that, so when we started giving 50 bags of groceries, because we started, it was all in-house, this is what we could afford, these were the donations we got. We are feeding, if I'm not mistaken, we are feeding a total of 300 families a month. By families, their families are getting two healthy, hefty grocery bags, and not just canned goods, to the point that the food bank of Long Beach has us as a food bank in the city. So when people go to the food bank of Long Beach, when they go to the food bank of the city, when they go to the kitchen of the city to look for food, guess what they're doing? They're referring them to the church. The amazing thing, it's costing the church nothing.
Yeah.
Because as our influence has grown, Ralph's, Vaughn's, Stater Brothers all know we do this. You know how you have bread that they have to take off the shelf, but it's still good for another 2 weeks?
Yes.
Guess what? Call us. We have all these things of bread. Come pick them up. You know how they have to sell on your meat? It says sell by, but use by. So a lot of this meat is, you know, you freeze it. It's good for a good old year, right? So we've had freezers donated to us. We've had, and so, but how did that start? We started serving our city.
Yep.
And there's power, the power, the authority, the influence that God gives you in the city when you start taking these little steps to seek the peace of the city.
You know, if you just to share this, because it's all about heart and mindset. I remember growing up in a church that was very much within its four walls. And I remember telling the pastor, why can't we do like a food thing to offer food to the people? And his response basically was, because they only come for the food and they don't stay at the church. And so I remember thinking, like, people are still hungry, though, you know? even if they don't stay in church, they're going to sleep hungry. And so we also learned that there are schools, neighborhood schools around our church, that have kids that are in the 98th, 99th percentile of poverty. Some of these kids get home ketchup packets so that they could eat that before they go to sleep because they're hungry. So we partnered with some of these schools, and we let them know, hey, contact us when you know that there's a need in a family. Contact us when there's kids whose shoes clearly don't fit them anymore. Like, let us know, because all of this could affect the child's education, their dignity, how they feel about life. And so let us serve you. And so we've had some of our team go and meet with the principals of the schools. And it's not that, I'll tell you, the body of Christ, it hasn't been something that's costly to us. We've done, like, beginning of the school year shoe drive. There's kids in our community who need shoes. Can you just bring tennis shoes, all different sizes? And people just begin to bring shoes because they're excited that they get to impact somebody else's life, because we get to be the church outside of our four walls. And so, you know, that's what we have, it's called our Urban Fin Ministry. And then we also have, you know, we live in a city that has a lot of people who like to ride their bikes. So then we have somebody who says, I can fix bikes for free. So they're like, every Thursday night, he's there fixing bikes. Bring your bike and we'll fix it for you. And he's there and he shares the love of Jesus with them, and he's fixing their bikes. And all colors of people ride bikes.
So it's, you know, not, when, you know, when you say it's free, everybody shows up.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
And like, and just looking for different ways to serve in the city and to partner. We have our Gems Uncovered ministry. One of the women in our church who led our women's ministry for years felt God had called her to reach out to the girls that are out in the streets. And so she said, I want to start this ministry. She literally retired from her job earlier than what she was supposed to. She opened up a drop-in center. God has provided her with all kinds of grants and scholarships from different organizations who are seeing what she's doing and reaching out to the girls that are being trafficked.
She's rescuing prostitutes
from the streets. And so this for us is great, because then we also get to train people in our church to volunteer at her drop-in center, to come alongside her, to help some of these girls get their high school diplomas. Just so many ways that you could serve a community that's so diverse and that is in need of Jesus. So one of our most exciting projects for us that God has basically put in our lane, and it's God's going to put these things in your lane, because he's going to say, hey, if you see that there's a need, then God's putting it in your lane. Right?
And none of what we've shared, I mean, it's so easy to think, oh, wow, everything has been difficult.
Yeah.
Everything has its tension.
Work.
Everything requires
meetings, conversations.
Theology of work. Everything requires faith.
Yeah.
Everything requires you to be walking with Jesus. I mean, without Jesus, we can't do any of this.
Yeah,
you know, because we don't want you to walk away thinking, well, I can start this. And if it doesn't start, why did it work for them and not for us?
Because
you have to embrace the tension.
Yes. Yeah.
You have to embrace the tension. You have to embrace the pushback. You have to embrace the fact that you're out here doing something good for people, and some of them are actually cussing you out because they don't want you to help them.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the truth.
Yeah.
Part of the truth is you're out there feeding and helping people, and there's always one that will come at you, and the devil will use them to cause you to almost lose your salvation. But because we're saved by grace, right? I mean, it's embracing the uniqueness of your community. Maybe your communities don't look anything like ours, but I guarantee you there is a cry in your city.
Yeah.
At some level. They can have the big houses, the fancy cars, the clothing and all that, but I guarantee you there's a cry in that home. And so wherever God has trusted you to be in, ask God to reveal to you what he's calling your church plant to do to meet the needs of those community. And then, you know, with all that, once you know you've been at it for a time, God starts trusting you with influence in the city.
Yeah.
You know, so I think one of our latest projects, God moved my wife to partner with not just foster care, but with the girls in the juvenile system.
Yeah.
So, kid you not, one phone call got the lead parole officer,
the chief
of probation for LA County. One phone call got her and over 15 probation officers.
Over 40
probation officers at our church. They had no idea what they were coming to. The only reason why it happened was because they know what 7th Street Church is doing. So you had this meeting with the chief probation officer, all these probation officers. They said, what do you want to do with our girls? You understand these girls are a juvenile system. They're not just going to give them to any church.
Uh-huh.
We just want to empower them. We just want to remind them that they're beautiful and that they're loved and that they're cared for. And then they start looking around the room. Well, let's see what your leadership looks like. Guess what? You actually look like our girls. Because
mm-hmm.
a juvenile, guess what? It's multi-ethnic by force.
Yes.
Yeah.
They don't have a choice. They look like our girls. We understand there's good intentions. To the point, let me show you, got me to the details, that when we had our first event, we've already done this for 2 years. Judges have come to the church to just like, we can't believe this. How come every church in our city isn't doing this?
Yeah.
To that point, one of the girls, you know, because they're juvenile for a reason, so there's gang life, there's control, and these two opposite groups saw each other at the church. We didn't even know that undercover cops were in our church building. We didn't even know. We thought they were social workers. And a fight started, I kid you not, within a minute.
Yeah.
Our whole property was surrounded by police. Now, for some people, we don't want police at the church. But again, it's influence. It's tension. I will embrace. I'm not going to let this situation destroy the greater good of some of the powerful things that are taking place in the lives of these girls, because as we're speaking life in, as we're reminding them that they are beautiful and that they are loved and that somebody in this city actually cares about them, you see the tears running down their face. You see them walking out of the church with a smile like, wow, this was amazing. I don't want to leave. They're hugging all of the girl volunteers like, can I call you mom for the day? Like, those conversations are happening.
Yeah.
You know, and it's influence that God has trusted us because we've embraced the tension.
And it's been, like Josh said, it's been by faith. Like the stuff that we're doing, it's just by faith. We're hoping, when we met with probation, we planned out the entire event, and we said, we're going to have at least 300 girls show up. And so 3 weeks before the event happened, we met with probation, we gave them flyers, we said, we just want to empower the girls. We want to give them an experience where they get to hear the stories of people who've gone through difficult things and women who are living out their dreams, living out their hopes. And so we're like, can you just tell them to come? And they were like, well, okay, I'll take them. I'll go through my caseloads and see who can come. And 300 girls showed up.
Wow.
And their caregivers, because their caregivers, just because they brought them, it doesn't mean that they're Christians. So we had all of these caregivers. We had these different shelter homes bring these girls. And we had a whole program for the caregivers. And we trained them and we gave them information. These are the things you need to look out for, because these girls are targets for human trafficking. Keep an eye out for these things. Be mindful of this. Be aware of this. Help us protect their future, because we learned that over 80% of girls that are being prostituted on the streets and who are in the strip clubs, over 80% of them were on somebody's caseload at some point.
Yeah.
They were young little girls who were put out in the system. So we thought, what if we get them before the streets do?
Yeah.
What if we give them something? What if we share a story? What if we introduce them to the presence of Jesus?
Yes.
And granted, our event is an empowerment conference. All of our speakers are pastors, but none of them are preaching at them. We're just
sharing. You gotta change. Yeah. You gotta give it after Christ.
We're just sharing the story. We're just sharing the story of like, this is what I went through. And then somebody invited me to a youth group, and you know, I found some hope there. And it's a simple message. But then we give them gifts, and in the gifts, there's message of Jesus and God's love and destiny and purpose for their lives. And we're trying to find ways to continue to have a long-term relationship with them because we don't want them to have a one-event experience. And so, does the city trust us? Yes. They said, what can we do for you to replicate this in other churches? There are so many girls in foster care. What can you do for our boys? I mean, we're trying to dream up what we can do for all the boys in foster care. It's not going to look anything like the girls' event, but we need to do something for them. Why? Because we're seeking the peace of the city. And so the peace of the city is diverse. It's colorful.
You know what's amazing with that, too, and we'll end with this, guys, ask some questions, is not only the influence and the trust of the city, but the trust of other churches in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So other churches who don't have neighborhoods like ours, they were just like, hey, we need to give towards that.
Yeah.
And we kid you not, we saw God's hand at work. Churches calling like, hey, we want to make a donation. What do you guys need? They, you know, someone rented out this big In-N-Out truck for us. We gave all the girls In-N-Out meals. And we're just like, oh my God, look at God's provision. So other churches don't have the diversity that our community has, but they're kingdom-minded.
Yes.
And they were like, we might not be able to do this like that, but guess what? We have some money and we can contribute to it. So it's not just the influence of the city, but the trust and the partnership with other churches. So we want to pray for you guys before you guys leave, but before that, you guys want to ask some questions, anything you guys are wrestling with or any questions that might resonate with what we've shared or maybe something we haven't shared with, but we've probably experienced it to some extent.
Can you give us some of your faith?
Man, that is... You'd be surprised how many times we don't have
everything. It's because all these dreams and plans you want to do in your community, and it's always the resources.
Yeah.
Like you said, maybe God will use another church.
Yeah.
Because you have the dream and the passion, and start making those contacts with the police, with the city, God will provide for you to have what you need to do the work that you want to do.
So yeah, I would say be faithful with what you have in your hands, and he will reward you with, if you're faithful with that, the rest comes.
And the volunteers in your church too.
Yeah.
So I think that's the hardest part, right? Is how many volunteers will get that passion that you have. So you have to transmit that passion that you have to your core leaders, to do a special training besides yourself.
So this conference is actually been addressing that. It comes down to that circle you've been hearing, the values, the narrative, and the behaviors, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
So for churches that are trying to shift their cultures, they have to go back and define, and we did that. We did that several years ago.
Yeah.
We went back to the drawing board and we realized we're doing a million one things and we're not doing one good thing at all. We're just doing a little bit of everything. And so we had to come back and have that tough conversation. What are our values? What's our narrative? And what's our behavior? And that volunteers, when they understand the value, the behaviors, they won't expect anything else because that's who they become. They are children of the house.
Yes.
They know the vision. Mm-hmm. And they're not expecting Josh and Noemi as the pastors explain it to them because they know that the writing on the wall is this. We are
offering hope.
Igniting hearts
to live in freedom.
We are offering hope, igniting hearts to live in freedom. Everyone knows that. All of our ministry leaders know that. Everyone on staff knows that. We want to do that and that alone, and then want to do that well. So that would be, anybody else, questions?
So three years ago, we united Spanish and English services. And then this month, we're launching a multi-site. And I'm the campus pastor, and I'm the only Hispanic on staff. And what happened, we had four practice services, and what happened is that all the Hispanics just followed me to the...
Came with you, right.
And and what we do, the best thing that we could think of, the quickest thing we could think of was to get me in front, I would do like announcements and stuff. Well, we did start doing video announcements so that people can still
see some of that diversity,
on the stage.
Well, what does that, the community that you're going to be planting, and what does that look
it's
like?
It's more Hispanic.
Okay.
It's like 40-60.
So again, I mean, you know, as new people come in, if you want to be intentional about serving the immediate needs, like for example, if we church plant in, are you from California?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a city in California, like if you go to Santa Ana or Southgate or La Puente, you know, there's these cities that are 90% Hispanic.
Wow.
You know, so you can't put your pressure, you can't put pressure on yourself
yeah.
for not being a multi-ethnic church when you're not in a multi-ethnic setting.
Yeah.
You know, but because you are a part of another church, I think those are the kinds of things you can do. It's like those video announcements.
We didn't want to lose that, but we are since I moved.
Yeah.
I don't know how we can keep a multi-ethnic mindset
yeah.
without having... being intentional about getting some color up there.
Yeah.
Then it's mostly just Hispanics and white people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, use the diversity you have.
Send some of your leaders who are non-white to the other campus to do announcements live.
Yeah.
And we wanted to reach second, third, fourth generation Hispanics.
Yeah.
We're losing them.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of Spanish churches and English churches, but they're all white, so
yeah.
we wanted to do something to
Yeah.
Questions?
Yeah, you have a multi-ethnic, right? But how about the member? You guys step out of the comfort zone. But how about members? Do they need to step out of comfort zone to mingle with other with people with other background?
Well, when they serve on any given position, whether they're part of the hosting squad or the children's ministry or the cafe. They're all volunteering, so they interact. They have to be on the same team together. So they end up serving together. Do you know what I'm saying? And that gives the opportunity for relationships and communication to begin to form. So it's not like if we're forcing, like, okay, you group. No, it's like, I want to be a host. Well, there's white people, black people, there's Latino people in my host team. So, okay, I guess I'm just already starting to, you know, my life is being sharpened by being around people who are different than me already.
Yes.
So it feels natural. It doesn't feel like it's forced.
It's that, and it's also the values, the behaviors, and the narrative. It takes you have to go back and see from the top down. If you're the lead pastor, if you're the church planner, what's the culture that you are raising? Because you know your church members are a lot like children. They're following your lead.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go wherever Dad takes us. You know, you're a spiritual father, and you know, and so. It's that, you know, you are intentionally placing people in areas of service where it looks different,
mm-hmm.
especially in children's ministry, because our children's ministry group looks so diverse, and if we only have one color of volunteers, it's like,
yeah.
you know, kids are like, you know, completely disconnected. It's not, we're not serving them well, so.
How do you train or how do you lead your volunteers and your leaders? Don't to be intimidated, or the people or the congregation don't to be intimidated when the juvenile or the other girls or the women come and they are not in the same level, so maybe I'm intimidated with them.
Yeah.
My kids. Or,
well, you know, we have different levels of leadership, so you'll have like a team leader and then you have volunteers. So. We are intentional, like in every area of our ministry. We drop it sometimes. We're not always that great, you know. But we are intentional about hospitality. So, you know, we don't have to speak the same language. You know, I've been on many missions trips, you know, where I, you know, you're the foreigner. You know, you're walking in. But there's always a sense of hospitality, like you're welcome in my house. And so we have to treat the house of God and your volunteers. Again, that's part of your culture. That's part of the values and the behaviors and the narrative. Like if you create that culture in your church, it won't be an issue. But if it's not, if it's an inward focused culture where it's us and, you know, it's me and the pastor and it's me and the deacon and it's me and the elder, every new person who comes in, as soon as they come in, they're going to see that groupie spirit in your church. And that groupie spirit, those cliques can destroy churches because it's, you know, it's toxic.
Yeah.
And it doesn't create space for people to connect. So,
how do you find more energy to keep? I mean, you do so much. We are out of breath listening to you.
You rest well.
Rest well.
You have to honor rest. The Sabbath is holy. Resting is a sin.
What day do you rest? Like?
It changes every week. We don't have a set schedule.
Okay.
But
yeah.
we've learned the last probably 2 years, we've learned to disconnect to the point where when we go on vacation, like our team knows, if someone dies, we don't have the resurrection gift.
Yes, amen.
So we'll know about it when we get back.
Yes.
We don't have to, don't bring the KFC. We don't have that gift. We can't do it. So, we've learned to do it where before, early on, when you're starting a church, you feel so good because people need the pastor, right? So they call you, come pray for me. Okay, well, what's wrong? I have an ingrown toenail. Like, you call me for an ingrown toenail? You serious? I left my house at 10 o'clock at night for an ingrown toenail. Yeah. You need to go to the doctor's, what you need to do. But at the beginning, and I would say this. I would go as far as this, especially for church planners. I shared this in another workshop. There's seasons that you have to be aware of as church planners. When you're a church planner, you have your church planning team, and your church planning team becomes like your family. Mm-hmm. They're having dinner with you. They're at your house several times mm-hmm. of the week. But as your church starts to grow and new people start coming to your churches, you have to create space for those people that are on your planning team to start doing that with them.
Yes.
If not, two things can happen. The new people will feel completely disconnected from you, and they'll see that click, or the people on your planning team will be jealous because you don't give them the time that you used to give them.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many churches get hurt like that. Oh, and they'll say stuff like this about you. They're not who they used to be when we started.
Yes. You hear that?
Right? It's impossible. How can you be the same with the 500-member church when you had a 50-member church? You have to grow. You have to grow. You have to adapt to changes. So I would say be careful with that, And so we give priority as our church has grown. Our leaders have priority. Like something happens in their lives, we are there right away. These are people we're doing life with. These are people, and it's not that we're not available to members. We meet with all of our members. Anybody wants to meet, but we've learned not to enable behaviors that say only the pastor can help me. We've become a life group church to solve that. So our questions when we meet with people is two things. Are you in a life group, and are you serving?
Uh-huh.
Because you'd be surprised how quick they'll stop calling you when they're in a life group or they're serving, because those two things will keep them so busy, they don't have time to worry about their problems. Just saying. Thanks for joining us, guys. Let's pray for you guys. God, I thank you for this incredible group of people, Lord. I thank you for the churches that you are in and those that you've already birthed. God, I pray for several things. I pray that you would give them an ability to listen to the unique cry of their communities.
Mm-hmm.
I pray that you would give them a sensitive ear and heart to listen to the voices that are screaming for help in their cities, God. I pray for their churches. I pray for their staff. I pray for their volunteers. I pray, Father God, for their marriages and their families, that you would just bless and be a very present God, Lord. I thank you for Exponential and just everything that's happening here over the last 3 days. And I just thank you for what's still to come our way, Lord. We love you. We praise you. It is in your great name, Jesus Christ, that we pray. Amen.
Amen.